You're listening to the Weekly Sermon Podcast from Trinity Church Denver. To find out more about Trinity, visit our website at trinitychurchdenver.org. And be sure to subscribe to this podcast in your favorite podcast player to get the latest episodes as soon as they're available. And now, please enjoy the sermon.
One of the concerns that John kind of sets before us, and he's been setting it before us in one way or another, over and over and over again throughout this letter, and he does so again here in this first paragraph, starting verse 11. It's something that runs counter to something that was very, very popular in my 80s and 90s childhood. I'll let you pick which decade was my childhood. And it was this idea that I was told over and over again is that you can be whatever you want. And so you would fill out surveys in elementary school where you would answer questions about your chosen vocation. What did you want to be? And it was a lie perpetrated on us throughout the whole course of our childhood. And so if you're a child here today, I don't want anyone to tell you you can be whatever you want to be. You can't. So for instance, there was no chance ever that I was going to play in the NBA. It doesn't matter how hard I worked. Doesn't matter if I just put my mind to it, I could actually do it. Didn't matter how many hours I spent in the backyard shooting hoops or going to the school up the hill that had a nice basketball court, and I would go there for hours and play one-on-one, me being both the ones against myself, and dribble and shoot and pull up and miss the last game-winning shot over and over and over again. There was no way in the world that I was actually going to be an NBA player. What would have been necessary for me to be an NBA player is someone to go and kind of rewire my genetic code, extend my legs, make me faster, athletic in some way. It was just going to have to be a completely different human being for me to actually do anything that I wanted to do. And yet over and over and over again in my childhood, I remember you go into class, and at some point over the course of the year, you would hear at least two self-esteem speeches where you would be told, hey, you can do whatever it is you want to do. Just put your mind to it, and you can do it. Just pick and go after it. I want to begin today's sermon by announcing to you that that is a lie. You can't be whatever you want to be. And it's not just because it's too late. For some of you, there was absolutely no hope ever of you achieving any of your wildest dreams when you were a child. And so, welcome to church. And so that's where I want to start. And this is, in some ways, where John wants us, wants to hammer home for us this idea that you don't get to be something just because you grit your teeth and work hard enough to become it. And right off the bat, even the most simple of things, the things that we kind of esteem and value as a culture, this command that he kind of has laid before us now at chapter 2, and now again is going to bring it before us in chapter 3, and really kind of explain it for the rest of chapter 3 and on into chapter 4 and 5, this command to love one another, just the most simple of commands. Not, hey, go play in the NBA. Not, go, hey, go get your medical degree and be a doctor right now. Not, hey, go and learn how to jump really high in the air. I don't know where that came from. Because that's something I can't do. nothing like complicated that is physically impossible. You have to train for a long time to do. Just something that sounds very, very simple. Something that's kind of esteemed by everyone in the culture. I doubt you'll meet anyone on the street today or in your neighborhood today if you said, hey, what do you think about the Bible's command that we should love one another? I don't know that you'll meet anybody that will say, I hate it. I think that's an awful thing to do. Like, everyone's going to say, hey, love one another. We're going to watch cheesy commercials with polar bears whose main idea is you should drink Coke and love people. Like, that's kind of the main cultural idea that's being shouted everywhere. And one of the ideas that John kind of sets in front of us in this letter is you can't. Like, unless something happens to us, unless some sort of rewiring takes place, unless God actually acts in a decisive way, in a way that is really absolutely essential for something outside of us to come and kind of rewire us, redo the genetic code, kind of extend our muscles and make them faster, change us from the inside out, we're never going to obey even the simplest, the most basic, the most foundational commands that the New Testament lays out. What John says here is the thing that we've heard from the beginning. In other words, not 201 Christianity, not like 301 advanced human living, no, just basic Christianity, basic to what it means to be made in the image of God. You and I can't do it. Something has to change. Something has to be rewired for us. And so I want us to look at, there's three paragraphs, so it's neatly divided into three points of the sermon. But I want us to dive kind of head first and spend an extended period of time in this first paragraph. But because John makes reference, he makes use of an Old Testament story that if we can kind of get to the bottom of what's going on in this story, I think it will open our eyes to maybe understand a little bit the kind of rewiring, the kind of work that God needs to do in each and every one of us for us to actually walk out and experience and obey this command, this very simple command and yet incredibly difficult command for us to love one another. So John, in verse 12, he says, "We should not be like Cain, who was of the evil one and murdered his brother. And why did he murder him? Because his own deeds were evil and his brother's righteous." Now, at first glance, this seems like a pretty self-explanatory verse, right? Like John is saying, hey, you should love one another, which at kind of like a bare minimum means don't murder each other. So John's kind of big point here is, hey, love each other. Point number one on how to love each other is don't, like, stab each other. Got it? Okay, step point two. But he's actually doing something much, much more with this story. And we need to kind of dive into this story to see what he's talking about. The story is actually taken from Genesis chapter 4. And in Genesis chapter 4, Cain and Abel, the first two kind of brothers, they enter into an act of worship. They come to bring sacrifices, to bring gifts to God. And then what occurs is God accepts Abel's sacrifice. Abel is Cain's brother. He accepts Abel's sacrifice. The text tells us that Abel worked with flocks. He had something to do with sheep and with cattle, and that his sacrifice was something from the work that he was doing with his hands. He brought that before God. God accepted that sacrifice from Abel. And then Cain, he brings his sacrifice to God, and God rejects Cain's sacrifice. Text is not piercingly clear on exactly why he accepts one and rejects the other, but he accepts Cain's sacrifice or Abel's sacrifice and rejects Cain's sacrifice. Cain is upset by this. Cain is sullen by this. He's ticked off. And so God comes to him and says, hey, just do what is righteous. Do the right thing. Do what is righteous before me, and then you'll be accepted too. Rather than offering another sacrifice, rather than offering a righteous sacrifice before God, Cain tricks his brother Abel, murders his brother, and then faces the judgment of God. He's actually sent wandering the earth for the rest of his life. Now, this is a famous story. Many people who've never even read the Bible can recite or know something about this story. I think there's been horror movies made about what if Cain lived forever and he's this evil guy. It was a bad movie, I think. But everybody kind of is familiar with this story. But I think we need to step a little bit further into it to kind of understand a few things about what's happening here and then what John is actually pointing us to. In anywhere that you see the concept of sacrifice, sacrifice always has to do with the notion of worship. It is if you offer a sacrifice to any god in the ancient world, but particularly within the Jewish faith, to God himself, you are coming to worship God, and more particularly, you offer a sacrifice because you want to be welcomed in. You want to experience and to know communion with God. In other words, the purpose of sacrifice, the purpose of worship, and I would say not just in the Old Testament, but actually the whole reason we've gathered in this room right now is because we long to be with God. We long to experience him, to know him, to sing to him, to hear him speak to us through his word. We want to commune with the living God. And so when you hear the story of Cain and Abel bringing sacrifices to God, they're not just going through religious ritual. They're actually both seeking something. They're seeking to come before the living God, to have their gifts accepted by God, to in the acceptance of their gifts by God, for them themselves to be accepted by God and be welcomed into communion with him. And so for one of those sacrifices to be accepted and one of those sacrifices to be rejected, something much bigger is going on. It's not just that the fire wasn't right. You see, the whole concept of acceptance before God, the whole concept of sacrifice by God, the whole idea that one of their sacrifices is accepted and one of their sacrifices rejected is a far deeper thing. You see, Abel was not just offering something that God took. God, in accepting that sacrifice, brought and gave communion with Abel, the very thing that he longed for most, the reason why he was coming, and in rejecting Cain's sacrifice, was rejecting Cain himself. You see, at the heart of this story is a story of a man being accepted by God and one man being rejected by God. I was reading a Jewish philosopher last night who was talking about this story of Cain and Abel. And he said it's bad enough to be kind of forgotten. So to not ever offer a sacrifice, to not attempt worship, to never try to come before this God, but to offer something and to be rejected, to maybe gather in this room. Maybe some of you, you're new to Christianity, or maybe you don't know what you think about Christianity, and there was some sort of fear about showing up in this room. And maybe it wasn't about God in your mind, maybe it was about being rejected by other people, or being thought funny because you didn't know when to stand or sit or say the right thing. But this fear in all of us, experienced and seen in Cain, that somehow we'll be rejected. That somehow we'll come on the last day, on some day before God, and find ourselves not welcomed, but rejected. John tells us this story not because he just wants to tell us, hey, make sure you don't murder each other as a starting place for how to love one another. He's actually hitting at what I think is foundational to any and all animosities that we feel in this room. Why does Cain kill Abel? He kills Abel because he sees in Abel something he longed for and yet didn't receive: acceptance. Something he wanted and didn't get: acceptance. Something that he had actually come before God to do and yet didn't get, and yet Abel received. So Cain was burned up, defined by his fear and his envy, his hatred for what his brother received and he didn't, and his fear that in the end, this was the last day, he would be rejected for who he was. Even though God told him, hey, just do what your brother does. Come before me in righteousness. Come before me in justice. Come before me in a rightly ordered way, in the way that we're going to look at in a little while, that your brother did. If you'll just do that, you'll be accepted. If you'll just do that, you'll be welcomed in. Now, Cain didn't want that. He didn't want to be rejected, and so he hated his brother. I think what John's hitting at in this story isn't just a command not to stab people. It's in the very foundation of what he's saying. For us to become the kind of people that love one another, we can't be like Cain, controlled and driven by envy and fear. And I think this is why, over and over again in this chapter, he's brought before us this theme of our acceptance, this theme that the God of the universe has welcomed us in as children. Because there is no firmer, no louder assurance to us that we are accepted. We have been welcomed in. The sacrifice has been received. We don't have to live a life constantly in fear that somehow on the last day we're not going to be welcomed in, that somehow on this day before God, he's kind of holding his nose, kind of waiting, kind of measuring our life to see if we measure up. No, that's that John wants to assure us over and over again with the clearest metaphor that he possibly can. You have been called now children of God. You have been accepted by God now. So don't be like Cain. Don't let your own envy and your own fear, this kind of underlying terror that somehow you won't be accepted and loved, don't let that be determinative for your life and how you relate to other people. Let me give a few of examples. I would argue that any place we find ourselves hating other people, And that doesn't necessitate kind of you holding a sign outside of their house, yelling at them. Hatred looks different in different contexts, right? We can admit that. But wherever you find hatred, at its root is envy and fear. At its root is a failure to understand and appropriate the reality that we have been accepted and loved by God on the basis of what Jesus has done. What is racism? Except an attempt to elevate one color of your skin over another person's color of skin. I hope it sounds ridiculous to you, because it sounds ridiculous to me as I say it. And yet it dominates the whole history of our culture. And what is it except for some pigment that I can hold on to that says, hey, look, I'm better, I'm righteous, I'm acceptable, I'm worthy, and they're not. And it's root, envy and fear, not of the other person, but of that somehow, if I could just somehow prove to God that I'm enough, prove to God that I'm better than other people, I can make myself feel accepted. Think about the interesting political conversations you had over Thanksgiving break. Wherever you happen to stand in those political conversations, I won't pick for you. I had a conversation with somebody this week, and we were John actually. We were discussing, like, why is there always so much heat attached to political conversations? I mean, we're talking about political ideals, right? We're talking about ideas about how government should function in the life of the people that they're responsible for. Why do those conversations come with such, like, anger and rage and, like, family members not speaking to one another? My wife just got back from visiting a family member who, like, he and his daughter, like, don't speak because they're on different sides of the political spectrum. And they think it's okay. Like that's like a thing worth kind of breaking communion with other people over, because I think the government should be bigger and they think government should be smaller, or vice versa. I'm going to try to keep you in the dark as much as I can. Like, what is that about? Why so much emotion attached to it? Because we find in these political identities some measure of righteousness, some measure that I should be accepted over against these other people who shouldn't be accepted. Let me maybe make it a little bit more personal. An experience just a couple of years ago, almost 3 years ago now, sitting with a friend, and this friend sat across from me and said some of the most sweeping and harshest criticism I've ever heard in my life. Like, devastating. And I remember walking away from that conversation and just enraged, sad, ashamed, and enraged. But what was interesting to me it's interesting now looking back, over the course of the following weeks and months, how much distance I intentionally created in that relationship. Now, I wasn't like picketing his house. I wasn't yelling at him. I wasn't throwing rocks through his windows. I wasn't kind of starting a website about how terrible this person is. I wasn't doing kind of overt hate. I definitely wasn't like acting like Cain and stabbing him. Like, none of that stuff is happening, but in a very real sense, I became emotionally detached from this guy. I didn't care about him. I didn't invest in that relationship. I didn't invest in that guy. Why? Because I saw in his criticism, and here's the thing, it didn't matter if they're true or not true, but I experienced in his criticism a sense that somehow before the God of the universe, I'm not accepted. I'm not enough. That somehow what I have to offer, what won't be received by God, that God hasn't adopted me, loved me, and sung over me. In some very real ways, if I'm honest with you, I hated him. I hated him for that conversation. I hated him for what I felt afterwards. Which all that exposes is that in some very real way, I'd attached my own sense of acceptance before God to the fact that this guy liked me, this guy thought well of me, this guy was maybe even impressed with me. And when I realized he wasn't, I was crushed by it. And so I hated him. I think what John is getting at in this story about Cain, is not just about murder. I think he hits at the very root of all all the things that keep us from being able to obey the command, love one another. We hate and we bite and we distance from people and we create coldness in our relationships and we have ridiculously loud arguments over politics and over all manner of different things, race. Because we're dying to find something to justify ourselves before God with. John says, don't be like Cain. Love one another. And this love, I want you to notice something else in the text. He says that in verse 14, look specifically. He says, we know that we have passed out of death into life because we love the brothers. Notice that he doesn't say, we pass out of death into life because we love the brothers. He says, we know that we've passed out of death into life because we love the brothers. And this order is essential. Because this order hits at the idea that you can't just make yourself a loving person so that God will accept you. He's saying don't be like Cain. In other words, be loving, and if you're loving enough, then God will accept you. That's not what he says. No, he says no. Like, God has given us life. God has made us children, to go back to the previous section of John. God has redeemed us and rescued us and put life inside of us. And the thing that happens when that life is there is it expresses itself in people who love one another. And you cannot get that backwards. You can't. It's impossible. I can't make myself an NBA player. I have to first be the kind of athlete that becomes an NBA player. I can't make myself a loving person in order to be accepted by God. No, the only way I ever become a loving person is if I can find and rest in and experience the reality that I'm loved by God. Last two points will be faster. Starting in verse 16, he says, by this we know love, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brothers. If anyone has the world's goods and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him? Let us not love in word or talk, but in deed and in truth. And so here in these two verses, John ups the ante. Three verses. John ups the ante. We live in a culture in which love is primarily sentimental. It's primarily something you feel and that other people feel. I feel like you're loving to me when you're nice, you smile, you bring me the appropriate kind of beer and smoked meat. Like, that's when I feel loved by you. Therefore, that's how I know if you love me. John is flying in the face of this. This is not the nature of love. Love is, I lay down my life for your good. This is how we know what love is. We look to Jesus. We see the kind of love that Jesus has expressed to us. And this, if that is the life that abides in us, if that's the love that abides in us, if we know the love of God, if experience the love of God, then that will be expressed in a love that looks like the love of God. And so it's not merely how you make me feel or how can I make you feel comfortable. No, it is how do I actually orient my life, use the gifts that God's given me to pursue your good. Now, represented in this room are a whole slew of different kinds of gifts. If you ask me to come and fix something in your car or in your house, that is not a gift I possess. It will go very badly. You will not feel loved or experience anything like love from me. But some of you are really good at that. Josh knows how to build grills that are wireless that will smoke your meat for you. Him using that gift to bless others, say me, would be a massive gift, right? Like, everybody has different gifts. So how, but whatever those gifts are, these things that God has given you, these kinds of skills, these maybe not skills, maybe he's just given you money or a house or a table that you can put food on. John says, no, the kind of love that I'm talking about, the kind of love that is born of this love from God being planted in you, that this life of God being put in you is a love that expresses itself by really taking everything that God's given you and you wielding it, you using it to care for and love other people. So he umps to Annie. It's not just, hey, how do you feel good about other people? Feel warmly about other people? Don't be like Cain. If you're not like Cain, if you actually have the love of God in you, then you're going to feel warmly about others. It's not what he's saying. He's saying, no, if you aren't like Cain, if you really know that you've been accepted by God, if you really know that you've been loved by God, if you really know that you don't have to fight your whole life to somehow earn something with him, but you've freely been loved, then it's going to cost you your whole life. Not to get it, but because you've received it. Your whole life will be oriented to the good of other people. Husbands, what would it look like if in your marriage, your husbanding was defined by orienting yourself to serving your wife's good? Which may not always feel great to her or to you, but actually pursuing her good. Using the gifts God's given you to care for, to nurture, to love your wife. Parents, what would it look like if, because you've been freely accepted by God, because he has loved you at enormous cost to himself by dying in your place, what would it look like if your life with your children was now, not just, hey, they're there, we kind of keep going, but no, my life is, I want to use all the gifts God's given me. And maybe try to find some I don't have yet, but use all the gifts God's given me to care for, to nurture, to pursue their flourishing and their good. How would your home feel and look and be different? But what if when you went to work tomorrow, back to work after Thanksgiving break, and you're in that weird kind of lull season between Thanksgiving and Christmas where you feel like you should be on vacation because, I don't know, I guess you had to go to school then too, but you know what I'm saying. It's that weird, I don't want to be here thing. But what if when you went to work tomorrow, and the orientation of your life was not just, I'm here to earn a paycheck and maybe be nice to some people. But you're actually asking the question, how do I take all, any of the gifts that God's given me and serve and care for these people? Like pursuing their good, pursuing their coming alive, even if it costs me. Even, maybe especially if it costs me. If I've been loved by a God who has laid down his life for my good, if I've been loved by a God who literally has died in my place, bearing my sins, and I could be adopted, and I could be loved, and I could know life forever and ever and ever, what would it look like tomorrow? Maybe in small ways. To say, I want this person's good, even when it's annoying, even when it's costly. This is the kind of love that John commands of us. This is the kind of love, John says, no, if you've really experienced that the love of God really abides in you, if you really, really know that he calls us children, you will love in deed and in truth. Last point, how? How do we love that way? And here John gets eminently practical, just like nitty gritty, like every single day, maybe every single hour, this verse should be a reminder to you. I wrote it on a note card and it's sitting on my desk because I think it's vital and precious beyond words. He says in verse 20, for whenever our heart condemns us, God is greater than our heart and he knows everything. John's going back now to the story of Cain. Like we live our life, and if you are self-aware, even for a moment, you recognize the fact that there is something not right, right? Like not wired correctly. Like you feel things, and you say things, and you do things to other people you don't need kind of the Bible to come and land on you. You just feel your own condemnation. You feel the fact that something isn't right with the way that I'm living. Something isn't right with what I'm feeling, with what I'm saying, with even what I'm doing. You recognize that. I think everybody here can acknowledge that there's moments in your life when you feel your own condemnation. And here's the beauty of what John comes and says to us. He doesn't say, yeah, right. Sit in that for a while. No, he says, God is greater than your heart. Do you know how precious that is? You know how many moments this week I sat and thought about how far I am from what I long to be, how far I've failed, man, just to love my children in the kind of way that John describes in this text, in a way that's self-giving, in a way that's oriented totally towards their good, to using my gifts fully and completely for them, for their thriving, to be confronted day after day after day with the realities of the way that I've failed, and then to be told in the Bible, God is greater than your heart. When your heart condemns you, when you feel that shame, when you sit under that cloud of knowing how far you are from what God has made you and commanded you to be, the beauty that John calls us to hour after hour after hour is your assurance, your confidence is not in what you feel, not in your ability to perform this week, not in your ability to do the stuff that you need to do in order to somehow be approved by God. Now, that's like Cain. Now, your confidence right now in this room, your confidence on Tuesday when it suddenly dawns on you, the thing that you said, the offhanded comment you said to your son yesterday and might have crushed him. And you feel condemned. Your confidence is not based on that word or that failure to keep your word or that failure to do the thing that you ought to do. No, your confidence is rooted in God and God alone, and He is greater than your heart. And that word greater, it's such a great word. It doesn't say He's just more powerful than your heart. It's not just that He's going to somehow kind of subvert and make you feel the right way. No, it essentially says, no, He's greater. He's more important than what He says about you. Is more determinative for who you are than what you feel tomorrow at 3 p.m. It's more real. It's something you can base your life on. Not your heart, not what you feel, not your emotions. From the fact that the God of the universe freely, joyfully calls you His son or His daughter. He accepts you. He loves you. And now anchored in that place, you can experience what He says in the next verse. Now, because God doesn't condemn us, that should shift what you feel, and your heart will not condemn us. If your heart does not condemn us, we have confidence before God, and whatever we ask, we receive from Him because we can keep His commandments and do what pleases Him. Knowing that He has loved us, knowing that He's welcomed us in, it will change the way you live. It will change the way you relate to your son or your daughter or your husband or your wife or your coworker or that annoying roommate or that annoying neighbor, whoever the annoying person is. It will change all of that because you will experience and know the sweetness of communion with a Father who accepts you, who loves you. Don't be like Cain, scrambling to find some basis for your acceptance. You don't have to be. Behold what kind of love the Father has given to us, that we should be called children of God. That Jewish philosopher I was reading was talking about the sacrifice of Cain and Abel and posited some theories, actually some well-rooted, founded biblical theories as to why Cain's was rejected and Abel's was accepted. The only difference that the text mentions is that Abel was one who worked with, day in and day out, he worked with blood. He worked with animals. And bringing from the fruit of his labor, he would have brought an animal and slaughtered that animal before the living God, therefore necessitating that to bring a sacrifice before God meant that you had to have blood. In a world after the fall, in a world after the advent of sin, in a world where we're not clean anymore, we must be made clean. Abel brought the best that his hands could do. He brought fruit. He brought the fruit of the earth. He brought whatever his crops could supply, but there was no blood in it. There was no sacrifice. There was nothing to atone for sins. And so the basis by which Cain attempted to stand before God, he attempted to stand before God on the basis of his own works, on the basis of what he could bring to that sacrifice. But Abel only stood because of blood. Abel came into the presence of God because something died in his place. We are sons and daughters of God because Jesus Christ has come. He's lived the life we couldn't live. He's died the death we deserve to die. He bore our sins on the cross so that all who put their faith in him, all who trust in him as Lord and Savior and King, will have even now God as their Father, accepted freely, loved freely, delighted in and sung over as a father sings over his children. Let's pray.